Giants, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, UFOs, aliens, Area 51, conspiracies, unsolved crimes, the supernatural. Are they real or are they figments? With your hosts, Colleen and Eddie Medina.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Figments, the podcast where we bring you the unknown, the unexplained, the mysterious, the spooky, and sometimes the... What was that? And sometimes the unescapable. What was that?
Oh.
Yes. No, I'm not talking about Harry Houdini. I'm talking about the infamous Alcatraz. Dun, 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 dun. Tonight, I am your host, Colleen Medina, and partnering with me tonight is my wonderfully cute, handsome, hubby-poo co-host, Eddie Medina.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Do you really think they can answer you?
Yeah, I honestly believe that.
Okay,
I do.
You would.
They can text me or...
Oh, okay, well...
Oh, anyway.
While you're reading those texts, I'll go ahead and talk. So, guys, we're going to talk about Alcatraz tonight, one of our favorites.
I love this story. I love it, The Escape from Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. And, I love how they made it into a movie with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage.
Hold on. That's The Rock.
Oh, we're not talking about Michael Bay's The Rock.
No.
So, no Nicolas Cage. So, I've been practicing my Nicolas Cage impression all week.
Are you going to save that for... something else. I'm not quite sure what that is, but
my Sean Connery impression. I can't use my Sean Connery impression tonight.
You sound a little bit more like Jimmy Stewart. But anyway, yes.
We've derailed quickly.
Alcatraz is also known as The Rock. Mm-hmm. And tonight we are going to talk about if anyone has successfully escaped. First of all, Eddie, why are you so intrigued by Alcatraz?
The escape story?
Yeah.
Or just the prison?
The prison, the escape story. I mean, the famous one is the Frank Morris and England brothers, obviously, but...
Yeah.
What is your fascination with Alcatraz?
Alcatraz itself, you know, just being a little kid. Well, just to kind of take a step back. When I was a kid,
step back from being a kid, or that would mean you're a baby. Do you really remember things when you're a baby?
Actually, I do. I'm that sharp and smart.
Okay.
Like Frank Morris, I am a genius.
Okay.
When I was a kid, you know, my dad was always a big Clint Eastwood fan. And so, you know, we grew up watching The Outlaw Josie Wells or the spaghetti westerns and movies like that. Mm-hmm. And so I was always big into Alcatraz because The Escape from Alcatraz. I remember seeing it at a very early age and was just fascinated with the story. Mm-hmm. And of course, they couldn't have picked a better lead, you know, in Clint Eastwood to play Frank Moore.
Oh, yeah.
Because she was, you know, so dynamic and...
Such a bad A.
Yeah, yeah. And you really were rooting for him, even though he was, you know, technically a criminal. You were really rooting for these guys.
Yeah.
And so at a young age, I guess that was my first exposure to Alcatraz, was that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, being fascinated with it, I did kind of poke around in the library and stuff back in the day before the internet. Mm-hmm. I would try to find out some stuff about Alcatraz, but it was mostly revolved around The Escape, Frank Morris and the England brothers.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my fascination started long ago, probably.
In a galaxy far, far
away.
Right.
But I don't really remember if I was a little kid or if I was already like in high school, but I think I've always been fascinated with Alcatraz just because of its reputation. It's kind of like the Titanic, the unsinkable. Well, we know how that ended. But the unescapable.
Yeah, it really is the Titanic of prisons.
Right. And if you think about it, isn't it the only prison that's actually an island that I know of? I mean,
I wouldn't know about that.
There may be others, but I know...
Well, Rikers Island, that's a prison.
What's that? Some nerd something or other, isn't it?
Well, it's where the Punisher was. I'm pretty sure it's a real thing.
Oh, well, then it's okay. Punisher. If it's a Punisher, like, it's okay. If it's anything else...
Whether or not it's real, I'm not sure, but I did remember reading about it in the Punisher comic book.
Okay.
So to me, it's real.
I just was fascinated with it because of its reputation, and I wanted to believe that someone actually escaped. And all these people are saying, no, no one's ever escaped, the water's too cold, the currents are too strong, the wind's too strong, there's too many sharp rocks out there.
Don't forget about the sharks in the water, which
turned out to be a myth. Yeah, well, I've always known that. And I've
I didn't. Growing up as a kid, it wasn't until I got much older that I found out that was just a way to deter the prisoners from escaping. Obviously, before it was a civilian prison, it was a military prison. Mm-hmm. And when it was still a military prison, they were notorious for the prisoners escaping and actually getting off the island successfully. And that's the thing. They were able to successfully escape and make it to shore mm-hmm. when it was still a military prison.
Right.
And so they introduced the whole myth of sharks in the water to kind of deter that, which there's no mad-eating sharks in the San Francisco Bay, only bottom feeders.
Right, right. Does that mean they feed on bottoms? Or
yeah, yeah.
Do they actually eat the whole person? They just
no, they're
the
butt sharks. They are butt sharks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, they
I've heard the waters are too cold for man-eating sharks, but I'm not quite exactly sure if that's correct or not.
Well, they're cold, and it does cause shrinkage, so the prisoners aren't fond of that, you know.
I knew there was a way that you would work something like that in. Moving on, I've always wanted to believe that the unescapable has been escaped. That's pretty cool, wasn't it, the way I rephrased that. So...
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Anyway.
That could be on a t-shirt.
I think it's pretty cool. Back in 98, I was already obviously an adult, and I actually visited San Francisco, and I actually visited Alcatraz. And let me tell you, being there, it was so cool. It was such an awesome tour. You know, we had a guide and walked us around. There were certain places that we couldn't go, but mainly we could pretty much go everywhere. He told us about the infamous escape, and we got to see their cells and the head and everything that we're going to get into here in a minute. But being there, it was just so neat. And I think while I was there and just seeing what they had to do, where they had to crawl out of, what they had to slide down and then swim across, I guess I just kind of wanted to think, man, you know, I'm here where these guys were, and I really want to believe that they escaped. And Alcatraz is actually a really, really pretty place. A lot of the pictures today show it's very run down. The buildings are run down, which they are. But it's got many, many gardens. I mean, it's just gorgeous.
It's funny that you bring that up. You know, growing up, I always heard Alcatraz was pretty much a hellhole, where it was, like, overcrowded and dirty and disease-infested, and the prisoners didn't get a square meal most of the time. And in reality, most of the prisoners who stayed there said it was actually a pretty pleasant experience, and some of them said it was the best prison that they had been in. It was actually a very well-kept, maintained, heated in the cold weather. It was a very well-run prison, completely different than what we pictured it as kids.
So what you're saying is they would recommend that to friends?
Mm-hmm. It was pretty much like a getaway.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was heated. They intentionally heated the waters more than most prisons, so the prisoners would not get acclimated to cooler water. So if mm-hmm. they tried to escape, they would get into the cold water and almost be kind of shocked and frozen and all that.
Oh, that's smart. So they conditioned them to the warmer water.
They did. Have you ever heard of anyone making that swim?
See, that's the thing. Everyone always wants to reference the Great Escape from Alcatraz, but prior to that, there were 12 other escape attempts and one that came after it. So 14 in all. And that's the thing. A lot of these you never heard about, but very intriguing stories. Like one of them, there were two guys that managed to escape by pinning back the bars on the kitchen window, if you can believe that. And they, you know, got out, and they, on the way down the slopes, one of them broke his foot or something, so he wasn't able to really keep up or even make it to the water before he was captured. But the other guy got in the water and was able to swim away. Of course, with the currents being so strong that particular day, he kind of got brushed toward the Golden Gate Bridge, and some teenagers out boating found him later, apparently, you know, stranded on some of the rocks mm-hmm. beneath the bridge, and he had hypothermia, obviously, and taken to the hospital and then carted right back to Alcatraz.
Oh, that was his reward for escaping. You get to go back.
Pretty much.
You can do it again. And people may wonder, well, how were the bars in the kitchen so easily moved or bent or broken? Well, that salt water destroys pretty much everything. A lot of times people who live on the coast, their cars, the paint will start just deteriorating. And it's really weird because when we would visit South Padre Island,
we would
see many cars that, you know, they were not old cars and half their paint was gone. So now I don't know.
You could look underneath the car and see a lot of rust, you know, decay underneath.
A lot of the, I guess, the convenience for the prisoners was that the bars, the concrete was, you know, not just mush, but it was easier to bend, break, cut through, you know, stomp through because of the salt water.
Yeah, it just kind of weakened it to a point. I mean, it was still difficult for them to get through. Obviously, it wasn't just like Play-Doh where they could just kind of claw their way out.
Right.
But it did weaken it some.
Right.
But aside from, there were other escape attempts. You know, there was one guy who managed to escape and he hid for like 2 days in one of the shoreline caves. And they had presumed him dead at that point.
Oh, wow.
And the whole time, he's hiding right underneath their noses, and it wasn't until he came out 2 days later that they recaptured him. And there was plenty of other escape attempts. It wasn't just, you know, this is one famous thing that had happened.
Now, weren't there a couple of people that actually swam from the mainland to Alcatraz?
Oh, like, yeah, for sure.
12-year-old girl?
Yeah, I don't know the exact age, but
it was a girl. Let's just make that point clear. A girl, not a boy, right?
Not a boy, yeah. Proving once again that, you know, whatever guys can do, girls can do better. So this teenage girl, it was before the prison actually became operational, I believe. I guess the public found out they were going to open Alcatraz, reopen it as a civilian prison. And to prove that it could be done, she swam from the shore to Alcatraz and successfully did it. But not just her. Fitness guru Jack LaLanne, who I'm sure many of the listeners know by name, he did the same thing. He actually strapped a rowboat. And I remember they made a big deal about this in the media.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, he strapped this rowboat to his shoulders and successfully himself made the swim also with, you know, hauling this rowboat behind him. I'm sure there have been others, but I do recall another story. This was more recently, like probably within the past few years, of two young boys who also made the swim from the shore. They probably dared each other to do it from the shore to Alcatraz Island, unbeknownst to their parents, obviously.
Well, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's pretty cool that those people did that. But the way I look at it, okay, if you're going to do it right. Start at the island and go to the mainland from there, or go to Angel Island. Don't swim from the mainland and go to Alcatraz. Because, you know, doing that, the currents may be in your favor. You know, if you're going to show the world, hey, this can be done, then do it correctly.
You're talking about the naysayers.
Yeah, I'm talking about anybody who's saying, you know, this can be done or this can't be done. You know, obviously the prisoners would be there at Alcatraz. Yeah, I'm talking about people who are trying to disprove or prove that it can be done. People can swim across. What is it, a mile and a half?
It's under two.
Under 2 miles.
More than a mile, under two.
What I'm saying is, if you're going to do it, if you're going to prove to the world it can be done or no, it can't be done, start at Alcatraz Island and either try to swim to Angel Island or try to swim to the mainland. It's cool that these people did that, but again, you don't know what factors were in their favor. It's pretty cool that young kids were able to do it.
Oh, it's wild.
Especially in that cold water. And let me tell you, whenever I was in San Francisco, it was the summer, and it was cold.
It was cold.
So I would not want to be them. But yeah, let's go ahead and get into the actual escape from Alcatraz.
All right. Let's start with the escapees, or actually the three escapees and the fourth wannabe escapee, Frank Morris.
Ah.
Now, this is a guy.
Frank.
Yeah, Frank and Beans. This is a guy. This is a guy who, you know, he didn't have much of a childhood, didn't have a stable home life, lost his parents at an early age, was moved around from foster home to foster home, and was probably getting in trouble in his early teens, probably 13 or 14. So he started his life of crime pretty early on. Just because someone's a criminal doesn't automatically make them uneducated or dumb.
Oh,
this guy was sharp. I mean,
he was genius. They actually have him there at Alcatraz as genius level, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Classified is what I was trying to say. Classified as genius
level.
Yeah,
in his file, if you were to read his file. Yeah, so this guy was a sharp as a tack. And so they picked an actor who would portray that very well in Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. And of course, you had the Anglin brothers, John and Clarence.
And let me say, John Anglin has my birthday May 2nd. He's quite a bit older than me, yes. But
I'm sure.
He does have my birthday May 2nd. And what's funny is both brothers were born in May, only 1 year apart.
Oh, wow.
I find that pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
Isn't that?
Absolutely hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give the audience a second to calm down from all the laughter that they're experiencing right now.
I just wanted them to remember my birthday, which is May 2nd.
Oh, gosh. Anyway.
That's all I care about.
John and Clarence were well known for breaking out of the prisons that they were in, and so was Frank Morris.
Oh, yeah.
So why in the world, number one, did they move them both to Alcatraz? Well, I know why, because apparently unescapable.
You mean the both of them or all three of them?
Well, all three of them, but more importantly, John and Clarence.
Yeah.
I mean, brothers who were known for getting together and escaping.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did they put them in the same prison, but they put them in adjoining cells right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's just crazy what they were thinking.
Let's send these brothers to the same prison, and you know what? Since we feel so bad about doing that, let's put them together, and that way they can have some family there. You know, I mean...
What voice was that?
That was my dumb...
That was...
I'm a big dummy voice. I don't know.
That was your prison warden voice. So then we got the fourth guy, Alan West, who for years, I thought his real name was Charlie Butts, because that's what he was called in the movie.
Charlie,
you know, and,
Butts.
Yeah, that's the joke in the movie, Charlie's
Butts. What's your name, Al Capone?
Yeah.
I love that.
We're assuming everybody's seen the movie. And if you haven't, go out and see it, or get on Netflix or whatever.
It's probably not going to be in the theaters, but yes, Escape from Alcatraz.
Really?
Clint Eastwood is
awesome.
And if you've never actually been to Alcatraz, it's a really, really cool place to visit.
Yeah, and after you see that movie, followed up with The Rock.
Well,
But anyway, Alan West.
So not a lot of people know about him. You know, a lot of people just know of Frank Morris and the Anglin, and it's always the Anglin brothers.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't know about the fourth guy, and apparently there were at least six people, and one of them, Clint Eastwood, Frank Morris said it wouldn't be a good idea for you to join us. And I'm not quite sure what was going on there, if he didn't think he was reliable.
No. What it was with him is he was on an upper level, and so they were afraid if he was going to dig out of his cell where his air vent, the grate, was at, would have been a lot more visible from where they were at because they were on the ground floor. He was also worried that once this guy started tunneling out, chunks of concrete might fall and alert the guards to what was going on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So that's what that was. So yeah, you got these four guys, and they're all sharp, even though Alan West in the movie was kind of portrayed not as smart, kind of like the chicken of the group. He went on record, of course, he's the only one who stayed behind, so he's the one who was able to give the account to the FBI. So we don't know if he retold the story
correctly
with him. With himself as like the brains of the operation.
Right.
But that's how he told the story to the FBI. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to figure out whether it was him, Frank, or I like to think it's a combination of all four, because Alan West was really sharp despite how the movie portrays him. The wheels were always turning in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
One time he was able to snag some hair clippers from the barbershop. He was in there painting or doing some sort of detail work and stole these hair clippers and was able to use the motor in a way to where he used it as a little hand drill for their escape plan. Unfortunately, the motor wasn't strong enough for what they needed for and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But then he kind of got lucky. There was a vacuum
lucky
cleaner.
In prison. Wow.
Yeah, imagine. That means something completely different when you get lucky, quote, lucky in prison.
Mm-hmm.
It usually involves dropping the soap. But anyway, so there was a vacuum cleaner that broke down, and he offered to fix it. Well, when he took it apart, he realized it had two motors in it, and he was able to, you know, smuggle one out and fix the vacuum cleaner in a way to where it ran on just that one single motor, so he was able to pass it off as a working vacuum cleaner back to the guards and was able to keep the secondary motor. And then they used that, and they fashioned it into a drill to use. I believe they used it on the bolt for the vent cover that was in one of the service, you know, corridors that they were going to escape through.
The ventilation,
Yeah, they weren't able to use it very much, though, because apparently it was so loud that, you know, they couldn't really utilize it to its fullest extent. But Alan was a sharp guy, so you had these four guys who are really sharp.
Frank Morris, we just talked about how he was genius level. Okay, so John Anglin, the older one that has my birthday May 2nd. When is my birthday? May 2nd.
God.
He apparently did not have a higher than a third grade education.
Oh, that's right.
And his brother did not have higher than a fifth grade education. So that just goes to show you that it doesn't take schooling for these guys to figure out how to break out of prison.
Oh,
they
no.
have a whole heck of a lot of street smarts. And you know what? Somebody can be really book smart and can have no common sense whatsoever. I've met many people like that. And there's some people that, you know, not a whole lot of book smarts there, don't do very well on tests, but they've got a lot of common sense and they can get themselves through different things. Something like this. So,
exactly.
Anyway, yeah. I find that interesting. And you're right. They were always thinking. And one thing about Alan West was one thing that he figured out to do. He was on paint detail. And I believe it was something that he wanted to do. So he was actually on top of a cell block and was trying to, quote unquote, paint up there. He was actually painting, but while he was painting, he decided, you know what, this is the perfect place, or maybe he didn't decide, but they probably all talked about it. This is the perfect place for us to be up here working on all of our stuff, our rafts and our life vests and all that. So what he did, he devised this plan that he's gonna, you know, whenever you paint, you sweep first, get the dirt, get the dust and everything gone, and then you paint, or it's all just gonna get in the paint. Well, if you've ever seen pictures of Alcatraz, the floors, they are shiny. They are clean and shiny. Even to this day, when you see documentaries or just pictures of back then, they were clean. What he did was he got his broom and he swept all the junk down there. Well, it ticked everybody off because they want their clean floors. And he's like, you know what, guys? I got to paint up here. I got to get rid of this junk. So I can't paint until it's clean up here. And he said, you know what? If you could give me some blanket, I can hang the blankets on the bars. And that way, when I sweep, the junk will just kind of hit the blankets and won't actually fall down to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And all the the guards, warden, whoever, it's like, okay. So he had like 3 dozen blankets, I believe.
What kind of Keystone Cop guards were in charge of this place?
Okay, let's give you. He really did. Boy, he really wants to keep this place clean. Yes, let's give him everything he asks for. So he got like 3 dozen blankets, and he laid them over the bars up there that, you know, shielded his way of just jumping off the cell block. And that way, it made it completely invisible for him to be, for them to be up there out of the guard sight. When the guards were walking around, they could actually look up there and they would only see blankets. Now, if those blankets weren't there, they could see everything they were doing. So people may ask, well, where did they make these rafts and these life vests? That's where they made it. And it was because of his
genius. That became like their little workshop, basically.
It was, exactly. And apparently, they did a lot of the noisy stuff during the, I think they had about an hour each evening to play all of their little musical instruments in their cells. Well, that's when they turned on the noisy things that they were doing up there, and no one could hear it because everybody was playing music.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. I mean, they timed everything perfectly.
Yeah, to take a step back real quick, we kind of jumped ahead of ourselves. They started planning the whole escape about a year before. Of course, the escape was on June 11th, 1962, where they started prior about a year. The actual escape plan, I mean, talking about it a year before, but the actual escape plan started in December of 61. So they really pulled it all together in a matter of just under 7 months from start to finish. And which is pretty amazing if you think about all the stuff they accomplished. I mean, within that 6 to 7 months, not only were they able to dig out of their cells.
Using spoons.
Yeah, using spoons. Well, hold on a second. So this was their game plan, basically, was to, number one, the plan was to dig out of their cells. They were going to fabricate these fake grates to go over the holes in the wall where they were digging.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to make these life rafts and life vests out of raincoats.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Morris had the idea of taking this accordion-styled instrument from one of the prisoners. They were going to use that as the pump.
Yeah, he took something out of it to where it wouldn't make the noise. It wouldn't make the music. It would just blow air.
And this is the crazy thing about it. Sometimes Hollywood will take these true stories and they'll take such artistic license that the final product is nothing like the real story. But what amazes me about Escape from Alcatraz is, it's not 100% accurate, but it's pretty darn accurate for Hollywood standards especially. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of the things right in the movie that actually happened in the true story.
Right.
And you see that where Clint Eastwood gets this instrument and all that. But yeah, they're going to use that as a pump. Well, the idea was to use this 3-foot-wide service corridor that ran behind their cells, which was hardly used apparently. It was nearly deserted. They're going to go along this way and shimmy up a pipe to a vent that eventually they were able to saw away the bolts and then pop the vent the night of and get onto the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Then use another 50-foot pipe to shimmy down the side of the prison wall and then make their way to the shore and to freedom.
Isn't there some song called Shimmy Shimmy something or other?
Shimmy Shimmy Coco Pop?
There you go! Yeah.
Oh my gosh. How in the world did we go from a Clint Eastwood classic to Shimmy Shimmy Coco Pop?
Who says shimmy down or shimmy up? Talking about Clint Eastwood or the real guy, I mean, they don't shimmy. They masculinely climb, okay? Or slide. They don't shimmy.
Hey, if Batman can shimmy, then they can shimmy.
Well, there you go. There's your answer right there.
Oh, gosh.
He does wear his panties on the outside. No, actually. He did use two panties on the outside. that's a different one.
So they were able to, within these 6 or 7 months, you know, dig out of their cells, recreate this little facade, you know, for the grate in their cells, mm-hmm. which they did really good at. They used just cardboard and soap mm-hmm. to create these things, and they painted them, got the paint to match mm-hmm. the walls. I mean, these guys were covering all of their bases.
They were.
So when it came time to get the materials for the raft and the life vests, they started collecting raincoats. And they ended up with 50 to 60 raincoats. And you're thinking, well, how did they do that? Well, apparently the guards, the people in charge, weren't all that concerned with handing out raincoats left and right, mm-hmm. apparently.
There was no limit to how many raincoats they could have.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The last thing on the guards' mind was that they were going to make life vests or rafts with these.
Yeah.
So, and another way that they were able to get them was one inmate would walk out, you know, outside into their playground area, I guess, with a raincoat.
Playground.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, with a raincoat on, and then would give it to one of the escapees. And uh-huh. that guy would wear it back in. And they did that quite often. And see, they had several inmates that knew their plan. And they got several of their supplies and tools from these guys. And there was no ratting them out. It was all, hey, you know, I'm not going to join you, but I'll do whatever you need me to do.
They had to return the favor. It's not like they were going to do it out of the kindness of their heart or anything. I'll get you this raincoat, but you got to do this for me. Just whatever.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so then they get these raincoats, and they were able to get their hands on some of the glue from probably the, who knows, what the woodworking department or whatever, you know, because they had access to these things. So they got the glue, and they were able to eventually make a raft that was something like 6x13, 6x14, something like that,
mm-hmm.
pontoons and all. So this was something that they were designing to carry all four men.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, Frank Morris, you know, obviously they also created the life preserver jackets, which were also inflatable.
Right.
They were really trying to cover all their bases.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to the beginning, talking about them digging out of their cells. Well, there's a vent down close to the floor on the wall, and that's what they were starting to dig around. And we already talked about how the concrete, the seawater had made the concrete so soft that it was eventually easy to get through that concrete. And it was like 8 inches of concrete. And so again, it wasn't Play-Doh, but it was, you could dig through it with a spoon. So once the hole started getting big enough, then they started making a makeshift grate to put over it to fool the guard. Seeing this in person, if you were to walk by, it would completely fool you. You know, I mean, they were very, very clever. They matched the paint identically. What other colors of paint would they have there? Beige, gray, whatever it was. You know, they probably didn't have many colors. So, of course, they matched it identically.
Well, another thing that worked in their favor in that respect was the fact that the cells were dim. They probably mm-hmm. were much more lit up in the movie for the sake of the movie, so you could see what was going on. The cells themselves were dimly lit, so that probably helped also.
So once Frank Morris and John and Clarence were out of their cells, they were able to go up on top of the cell block. I'm not sure which cell block it was. D or C, whichever, but the one that I had mentioned where West had put those blankets up, they, you know,
the workshop.
Their little workshop up there. That's where they did most of their work. And apparently, they were pretty much out of their cells after 9:30, because 9:30 was the last head count. You actually had to, I guess, get out of your bed or look up at the guard. The guard would wake you up. After that, the guard would just walk by and make sure that your head was there in the bed. So in order to do that, that's when they realized, okay, in order for us to be in our little workshop up here, we're going to have to figure out something to fool these guards another time. So they get soap and what was it?
It was a mixture of toilet tissue, soap, and concrete.
Concrete
powder when they were digging their wall out.
And they made fake heads. And we all, you know, have heard about the fake heads. And they used the hair clippings from the barbershop and, you know, stuck them on there.
They got the flesh tone paint from the arts and crafts kit so they would let the
right.
prisoners.
They even had little eyebrows and everything. So when it was time for them to be out of their bed, they would have the head, and their heads always had to be towards the bars. The guards.
You do the head count. That's where the term head count comes from.
So the guard could see the top of their head. And so all they had to do was put that head in there, kind of put the covers just right, and then get out of their cell, pull the grate back, and they were good to go. And it fooled the guards perfectly. Like you were saying, they pretty much thought of everything. Could you imagine the step-by-step-by-step process that these guys, you know, well, if we do this, we have to do this. And if we do this, well, we got to do this first. That would drive me crazy, you know?
That's what makes the story so impressive is they didn't give up through all these months. I mean, it would have been
easy
for these guys to just at some point to say, man, this is getting crazy. We can't do this and just give up. But they never gave up. They were so focused on getting out of there. They were so focused on their freedom that they just kept on and on trying to think through every problem that may have arisen or every scenario that might have popped into their mind. They probably had tried to have a contingency plan for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these heads, I know you've seen them in person, Colleen, but you can see photos of what these things look like, and obviously they deteriorate over time. But
they
even
look ridiculous now.
Yeah. Even brand spanking new, I'm sure they weren't that impressive to look at. They weren't like Hollywood quality.
No.
They were obviously good enough to a point.
They were good enough.
They were obviously good enough because I know one guard mentioned that when they discovered that they had escaped, and before they knew that they had escaped, he was telling the guy to get up out of bed, and when he wasn't moving, he went into the cell, and when he bumped him to get up, the head rolled onto the floor, and it was obviously convincing enough to when he saw it, he thought that someone had decapitated them.
Yeah.
Had kept prisoners.
Yeah, so, I heard the guard. Guards talk about how it startled them.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, who wouldn't be startled? You think the inmate's laying there, and then when they're not moving, you think that they're either dead or they're really sound asleep, and then all of a sudden their head goes rolling on the floor. I mean, who wouldn't be startled at that?
So now we're to the point now. They've gotten out of their cells. They've made themselves a raft.
Well,
made themselves
hold on. Not all of them have gotten out of their cells.
Yeah, that's true. Go ahead.
The one guy who claims when he told the FBI his story, he said, you know, he was the mastermind behind it. It was all his idea. Couldn't have been done without him. So whenever he started cutting his way out of his grate, he made the hole too big. So he was unable to cover it up. So what the England brothers had to do was come up behind with some cement because they kept a lot of their cement and then they flushed the rest of it away. So they still had cement, and of course, you know, they had water in their cells. So they got the cement and patched it up. Well, they patched it up so good that now was too small for him to get out. And they probably did that thinking he's got plenty of time. You know, this wasn't just the last night. He's got plenty of time to kind of dig his way through in order to make it the right size to where he can make the makeshift grate and all to fool the guards. He didn't do that. He spent all of his time working on everything he was working on in his cell. And what he would give to them, they would come to his hole in the wall, if you would, and he would hand it to them that way, and they would go on, you know, whatever they were doing. Now, I know it's kind of iffy about exactly when, if they knew, okay, we're going to leave on a week from tomorrow. And
as the story goes, Frank Morris called it the day of. He said, we're going tonight.
Yeah.
The account that Alan West gave was that Frank Morris said, we're going tonight.
Yeah, and he says that, and then, you know, we've heard from other accounts that they were going to go around this time. But even so, here's a guy who's putting this whole thing together, been thinking about it for a year, been working on it for 6 months. He knows his hole is too small. So what is his main priority now in order to escape? Is to get out of that hole. But he doesn't work on it. He's working on all this other stuff. So he waits until Frank Morris says, okay, I think we're going to be able to leave tonight. We're going to be able to get out. If we can get out of the ventilation shaft on the roof, you know, we'll be out at 9:30. So he starts to panic. He's not able to get out of his own cell. And he's chipping, and he's digging, and he's kicking, and nothing is working. And so Frank Morris keeps coming by, checking on him, and he's saying, I can't get out. Frank sends John and Clarence down to kind of kick away and do what they can. They can't get him out. And then the story kind of goes iffy from there. I always heard that the fourth guy was unable to get out because there was a bar back there behind his vent. Now, when he told the FBI his story, he didn't say anything about the bar, did he?
I think that was the account he first gave the FBI probably the next day.
Okay.
But I guess once they looked into the story further, I guess they put two and two together and realized he actually did, you know, get out and get down the corridor. And the way it plays out in the movie, and again, this is the movie, but I think they've kind of pulled from real life. He gets out, he goes on the corridor, but by the time he gets to the Swan Park, he can't make the jump. But I think in real life, when Harry gets to the roof, he realizes it's too late, they're long gone. So he has no choice but to go back to his cell and wait out until the morning.
Right, right. So I just find that funny that the person who claims to be in charge of it all kind of was a bit of a dip in waiting that long. Because, again, yeah, he did not know, okay, this we're going to leave tonight. He may not have known that. But you know what? You can't leave if you can't get out of the dang hole.
Yeah,
so that was
yeah.
his number one priority, was to chip away that hole. So I find that funny.
Okay, so this is what we got so far. They've dug out of their cells. They've fashioned their raft, their life preservers. They've sawed away at the bolts on the vent that leads to the roof. So they're good to go.
And they've already done that. So all they had to do was push the vent up to where they could get out. They sawed the bolts away. They were already prepared.
Ahead of time.
Right.
Yeah, that was done ahead of time.
Right.
Okay, so here we are, you know, June 11th. So lights out is at 9. So by 9:30, that's when they start their move. They get out of their cells. They realize Wes can't get out. One of the Anglin brothers, I think it was Clarence, tried to help him out. They realize they have to go. So they go ahead.
They have to go potty or...
Yeah, they have to go potty.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah, they didn't think to do that ahead of time.
Yeah,
before.
That's...
It's like when you go on a long trip.
Oh.
You know, there's always one kid that doesn't go bathroom, and you're on the road. And
that's me. That's me. I hate that. I hate it when that happens.
I figure as much because you have a bladder the size of a pea. I get a pea.
You know, I didn't get that at first. Anyway, go ahead.
So 9:30, they start to make their move. They go down the corridor. They make the first something like 30 something foot climb up the piping to the roof. They get to the roof, and it's like 100-foot dash to, I guess, to the point where they can climb down another pipe.
I believe they went on the far side, which means they were trying to go in the opposite direction of the watchtower. And the watchtower,
yeah, right.
The watchtower, whoever was up there, did not have really that great a visibility at night, especially because they didn't really think it was necessary because they didn't think that anybody was going to be escaping. So, again...
Well, that was like an area they thought was least likely to be used to escape.
Right, right.
Then they dart across the roof, and they get to a point where they can go down a 50-foot pipe, and that's when they make it to the ground. They get to the water's edge. They inflate their raft and their life preservers using this accordion thing, and that's where the facts end and the speculation begins.
Oh, speculation. I love to speculate.
Yes, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get into the speculation part.
Okay, let's let's speculate.
Naysayers will say that they could not have survived the swim. Now, the plan was to swim to Angel Island. Is that correct?
Yes, and I've also been to Angel Island. I don't think I said that before, but I have.
Cool. So Angel Island, because there was least likely to be caught there, I guess.
Right.
And from that point, the plan was to steal some clothes, steal a car, steal a gun or guns. And then West never gave the FBI anything more beyond that point. Like, he didn't say the plan was to go our separate ways and meet up later, or we were all going to go together to this location. You know, he never said that they had an actual point B that they were going to end up at.
Mm-hmm.
Just that we were going to get to shore, we were going to get a car, get weapons, get clothes, and go.
Mm-hmm.
Get as far away as possible.
Right.
So that was the plan. Again, naysayers will say they could not have made it because of the current. It would have swept them out to sea. They would have died of hypothermia. The water was too cold, and this, that, and the other.
Their bottoms would have gotten eaten.
By the bottom-eating sharks, that's mm-hmm. right. They love to feast on butts.
That's very important.
Yeah, that's going to be another Asylum movie, Butt Shark.
Oh, ooh, can't wait for that over the summer.
Butt Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Aww.
That one's for you, Andy.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what they say. They said that, you know, they had all these odds stacked against
mm-hmm.
them. Okay, I like to believe they made it.
Me too.
And I don't know, it's because when you, growing up watching the movie, you rooted for them almost in a Robin Hood type way. Not that they were stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, but they were the underdogs.
Mm-hmm.
They were bucking the system. You know, they were doing this, spitting in the face of the man. And even
mm-hmm.
though as kids, we didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
It was just that feeling of the underdog doing the impossible.
Right.
And maybe that's where a lot of that comes from, that I want to believe that they made it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
That they made it. You have these guys on these shows that will go on and try to disprove it. You know, we saw this one reenactment, you and I, Colleen, where
uh-huh.
the guys were in the raft and they're saying, oh, we don't feel like we're getting any closer to the shore, and they would have never have made it. And they're just being so cocky about it.
Okay, I'm sorry. What voice of that was?
Oh, that's my cocky recreation guy.
Okay. Still a little bit of Jimmy Stewart there. Boy, you like him, don't you?
I guess so. So they say they can't make it. Well, what they're not taking into consideration is the desperation these guys had. When you remove desperation as a factor from it, it's going to change things drastically. These three guys had the stink of freedom on them. They wanted their freedom. So when you factor in the sheer will to get across to the other side, get to freedom, and start a new life, that in itself could accomplish so much more than what the speculators or the naysayers will say that you can do.
Well, think about your willpower. Think about mm-hmm. when you feel like you cannot go any further because your body won't let you, but
yeah.
you know that you need to take that last step or push mm-hmm. yourself that last few steps in order to completely get around the mile marker or whatever it is. And like you said, they had freedom in their sight. And
yeah.
and that was part of the beauty to the warden and the guard, and also the ugliness to the prisoners, was that sight of San Francisco. That close to them. They could look
yeah.
out the windows and see San Francisco and see the lights and, you know, just see everybody there living it up and the freedom that those people had. You know, when you see that, when you have that on your mind constantly, okay, so we're going to break out. We've thought about this for a year. We've worked on it for 6 months. So we're going to let a little bit of cold water get in our way. I mean, yeah, it was the summer. Summer had just begun. And even though I did say I was there, and I was there in June, and they escaped in June, and it was cold, but I didn't have freedom, you know, in front of me. I was already free. I didn't need to be desperate and run on pure adrenaline. Think about when you're running on adrenaline like that, and then you've got three of them huddled together. And again, I don't know that we've talked about this before. We know that they used between 50 and 60 raincoats in order to make this raft and the life vest.
Yeah.
Who's Who's to say that as smart as they were and as many people as they had doing them favors, that they did not have on extra clothing? I mean, who's to say that's not possible?
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
We've never, as often as you and I have talked about this off mic, I don't think we've ever mentioned that.
Right, right.
That's a good point.
I think I actually just thought about that the other day. You know, you think about...
You heard it here first, guys. Figment's exclusive.
Exactly. You think about... These were not just, let's see if we can try to escape. Okay, you want to do it tonight? Sure, that's fine.
Here we go with the voice.
There you go. That's not what it was. These guys were prepared. Okay, so they're out there. They see whichever direction they're going. Angel Island, San Francisco, whichever way. They see freedom in front of them. They're going to try harder. They're going to give it that one last push. They're going to go that extra mile to at least get to where they can touch the bottom and walk the rest of the few feet onto shore. And you know what? If the currents are not in their favor, think about this. I think you mentioned this another time. They're so well at adapting to everything. Think about them in the water. The currents are just pushing them this way, pushing them that way. Maybe they're not going quite the direction that they want to go in, but they're thinking, we're leaving Alcatraz. We're not going in that direction anymore. So instead of fighting these currents, we're just going to let the currents take us where the currents want us to go.
Yeah.
You know?
They could have rode the currents to a different part of the shoreline.
Exactly.
And just because Angel Island was their initial, you know, go-to point doesn't mean that once they got on the water and they realized the current was taking them past the Golden Gate Bridge, they would have easily have come up with a plan B just to, okay, let's there. That's where we're going, is that spot there.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing, because the naysayers will say that the currents did take them away from Angel Island where they were wanting to go. But they were also saying that that night, winds were blowing in the opposite direction by 15 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that nearly would have canceled out the current taking them in one direction. So they said they could have very well have, you know, one would have canceled out the other, and that would have made their swim across that much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that the naysayers like to say is that...
You like that naysayers, don't you?
I know. Is they like to say that one of the reasons why they can say that they didn't make it was because the plan was to steal a car and to steal clothing. And the FBI report, the official FBI report, said that there were no such reports of stolen clothes or stolen car.
Oh, of course not.
I know.
That's unheard of.
You know, just because they couldn't steal their clothes from some storefront that they broke into doesn't mean they didn't get their clothes some other way,
mm-hmm.
you know, off of a clothesline or something.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the other thing. Apparently, it came out much later, but this was not in the FBI report.
Shocking.
Which said that there was no reports of a stolen car, but apparently it was reported that a blue sedan was, in fact, stolen that night. So there was...
Interesting.
There was a car that was stolen that night, that was reported stolen.
Well, was it reported stolen that night?
Or the next night, or the next year.
But it was reported stolen. I wasn't sure if I got that. It was reported. Okay.
Can you repeat that?
No. And so, didn't we find out that when they were searching for them, like that morning, because, you know, bright and early that morning, they went on the manhunt, they saw a footprint leading from the waters onto, was it Angel Island? Or
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Where the raft debris and the ore was found. Now, this is the other thing. I'm glad you brought that up. For years and years and years, it was said that no one mentioned anything about footprints. It wasn't until some documents were released. I could be wrong, but it's something like in the vicinity of 2010, as it was approaching the 50-year anniversary, I believe, the U.S. Marshal, who's still currently working on the case, he said that some documentation was found that stated that footprints were, in fact, found on the shore leading away from the raft onto the mainland. So
onto the mainland. Okay.
Well, you know what I mean.
The Angel Island or...
Angel Island, sure.
Okay. Well, there's two different places there. Wasn't sure.
And so, but the fact remains that they did find footprints.
And
said that there weren't.
You know, the FBI is notorious for giving us exact, correct, truthful information.
Well, we don't need to speak against the FBI because they might be listening.
Oh,
in,
yeah,
so.
They might be.
We'll edit that out.
Yeah. Take that back. I'm sorry. The warden, wasn't it the warden that received a few, like maybe like 5 days later after the escape, received a postcard?
No, that was the FBI.
The FBI, okay.
A postcard was sent.
A postcard that was signed Frank, John, and Clarence, and then it said something like, ha-ha, we made it, or ha-ha,
yeah,
we did it.
Yeah,
but
something to that effect.
I like to think that it was them, but, you know, they could not match the fingerprints or the handwriting. It could have been anybody, but, you know, I kind of like to think that they all were like, yeah. And, you know, if you go to Angel Island and you find a carnation, a flower there.
Oh,
you know,
that was just in the movie.
You
that
know
was
they
not
escaped. I mean, come on.
Gosh.
Well?
Yeah, that was just in the movie. But on a serious note, the Anglin family, they believe that the brothers survived. Whether or not they're still alive is another story because they would be in their 80s. The Anglin family believes they were alive, and they point to the fact that a phone call was placed not too long after the escape to a woman who resided in San Francisco, and the voice said, "This is John Anglin."
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Another thing was that same year, that same year, a Christmas card was sent to the mom. And the family still has this Christmas card in their possession. Mm. And on it, it said, "To Mother from John, Merry Christmas."
Aww.
Here's an interesting side story. There was a third Anglin brother that a lot of people don't know about because you always hear of just the two involved with the Alcatraz escape.
Right.
But they had a third brother, Alfred, who was also a bank robber like themselves. And he was in an Alabama prison. Unfortunately, he had tried to escape a few years later and was electrocuted on the fence as he was making his escape and died.
Oh, my.
That's the official report. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the thing that confuses me, why we're getting two drastically different stories, but the Anglin family says that the third brother was killed, beat to death by the guards of that prison because he refused to tell on his brothers because apparently he knew of their plan. They had a plan amongst the three of them that once they were out, once he escaped, they had a plan to all meet up together. The family says that the guards beat him to death because he wouldn't give them the info that they wanted.
Yeah.
So that's so odd that we're getting two stories on his death that are so drastic from each other. I mean, either it's one or the other.
But think about this whole story of Alcatraz. We're getting so many different versions. There was a bar in the way. There wasn't a bar in the way. He lost his nerve. No, he got to the top. Frank Morris was in charge. No, it was what is his name? Clayton? Alan West?
Alan
West. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Sean Connery got off the island. No, Sean Connery didn't.
Exactly. And
yeah,
then
there's so many things back and forth.
How the other brother died. And so that kind of is also not just the escape, but all these other factors. And the report, the FBI report of later on about the car being stolen.
No car and car stolen. No footprints. Now there's footprints.
Right.
It makes you wonder which ones are real and which ones are figments. Ah.
Of your imagination. That's right.
But this is crazy. I mean, look at us. We're 52 years later, and we still don't know what the true story is. We still don't know what the fate of these three men were.
I'd like to someday find out.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess when we get to heaven, that will be one of my questions. When I'm in line for 5 hours. So any last thought?
I think we pretty much covered it, honestly. I like to believe that they made it. That's my final thought.
I like to believe that they made it, too. You know, I think that just kind of goes to show our personalities. We like to, this is kind of why we do figments, is we like to believe the things that most people maybe don't believe and like to have an open mind on things. You know, like I said, if you've never visited Alcatraz, it's a great place, great tour. It's really cool. And if you've never seen the movie, Clint Eastwood, always, I mean, Clint Eastwood's good in a commercial, you know? I mean, seriously. And what is he like, 90-something, 80-something? I'm going to get in trouble with that, but
140, I think.
Oh, that's right. I mean, he's still a bad A, okay? So watch the movie if you haven't. We'll end it with this. This is a 52-year-old mystery. We may never find out the fate of Frank Morris and the Anglin brothers. But guys, when we're thinking about all the questions and speculation, remember to ask yourself, are they real or are they figments? Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.
Figments is a production of EdMed Art Studios and hosted hosted by the Jedi Cole Universe. You can find us at www.jedicole.com and www.eddiemedina.com. Thank you for listening, and keep searching for